You're listening to Zen Crossing, where spirituality meets everyday life, with your host, Koshin Chris Kane, abbot of the Puget Sound Zen Center.
Today we'll be talking about healthy honor and healthy shame with Tanisiro Bhikkhu. Tanisiro Bhikkhu studied for 10 years under the forest master Ajahn Phuong. Since 1993, he has served as abbot of the Metta Forest Monastery in San Diego County, California, the first monastery in the Thai forest tradition in the United States, which he co-founded with Ajahn Suwat Suvacho. Tanisiro Bhikkhu is perhaps best known for his translations of the Dhammapada and the Sutta Pitaka, almost 1,000 suttas in all, as well as for his translations from the Dhamma talks of the Thai forest Ajahns. He has also authored several Dharma-related works of his own and has compiled study guides of the Pali translations. Tanisiro, thanks so much for coming.
It's my pleasure.
I've heard you talk about two kinds of shame, unhealthy shame and healthy shame. Can you explain the difference between these two as you see it?
Well, unhealthy shame is basically the opposite of self-esteem. It's the kind of shame where you feel that you're a horrible person and that you're incapable of doing anything right. Hmm. Healthy shame is the opposite of shamelessness. In other words, it's a sense of honor that you might have that there's a certain kind of behavior that is beneath you and that it's not worthy of you as a person, which is why it actually is a sign of high self-esteem. You see that this behavior is not worthy of your even considering doing and that you're above it because that reason you won't do it. And the Buddha talks about this kind of shame as what he calls a guardian of the world. It protects us from doing the things that we're later going to regret, things that would harm other people.
Can you talk about honor? In addition to shame, honor also having the potential to be both healthy and unhealthy.
Right. They're closely related because both of them have to do with your sense of how you look in the eyes of others. Shame is when you feel that you look bad in the eyes of others, and honor is when you feel that you look, or your desire to look good in the eyes of others. And unhealthy honor can be based on strange ideas of what others expect out of you. What makes it unhealthy is you're actually looking, trying to look good in the eyes of the wrong people. People would say not to respect you because you don't fight when someone makes an insulting remark to you, that sort of thing. A healthy sense of honor is when you have a strong sense of your own moral code and that there are people who would admire you for being moral and would admire you for behaving in a way that shows integrity, and you want to look good in their eyes. And that's actually healthy in the sense that it, again, provides a motivation for you to do things that are going to be skillful and will be harmless both for yourself and for other people.
Hmm. But in order to have that healthy kind of honor and shame, I guess it's important to surround yourself with what you call admirable friends and a community that contributes to that healthy sense.
Right. All too often we think of honor, say, when you become a soldier, they start talking about a lot about honor. But the Buddhist sense of honor is something that's very unmilitary. It's interesting that he uses the image of an elephant battle to illustrate his definition of what he means by a genuine sense of honor. It's a military image, but he plays with it in a way that ends with a very unmilitary definition of the concept. A person who protects his principle of truthfulness is like an elephant who protects his trunk as he goes into battle. And he will use it to fight. The person who doesn't protect that principle is like the elephant who will use even his trunk in battle and who, in the Buddhist words, has given his life to the king, which nothing will do. Now, in military terms, the second elephant is the ideal model. Every soldier should be willing to give his life for his king, right? Mm. But for the Buddha, the first elephant is the ideal. In protecting his trunk, he's no one's servant. In the same way, when you protect your truthfulness, you're no one's servant. And in this way, the Buddha defines honor not in military terms, but in terms of moral terms. Mm. But he had an implication that only when you stick to your moral principles are you truly free.
In your article on shame in Tricycle that I found fascinating, you start with the Buddha asking his son, Rahula, to look in the mirror and examine his actions to make sure that they haven't led to harm.
Right.
It made me wonder, in your community, is there any formal or ritual way to do that, you know, to hold up a mirror?
Well, each monk is asked to look at his own behavior and measure it against the Patimokkha and the other rules that we have in the Vinaya. And if he sees that he's broken one of the rules, then he's supposed to confess it to someone else. We have a two-weekly ritual where we kind of go through that.
You do?
As a group. But we're also encouraged on kind of a daily basis. If you realize that you've done something wrong, talk it over as soon as you can with a teacher so that you can talk about, well, why did you do it wrong and how could you not do it wrong the next time around?
How about teachers themselves?
Teachers have to again, they can be called by the students. You know, if the student sees the teacher doing something wrong, the student has the right to say, was that really in line with what we're supposed to be doing here? Which, of course, means that if you want to be a good teacher, you don't behave in such a way that your students are going to call you on that kind of thing.
Well, yeah. Of course, if we're lucky, the students will do that. It's interesting to me because we have something called Sangye or Sangyemon in the Zen tradition, which is a kind of confession and repentance chant that we do. And it feels like it plays an important part in our tradition.
Right.
And it's not used as often as maybe it ought to be. It's one of the things I think that drew me to your work on shame and guilt and confession. Yeah.
There's an important part of this is that on the one hand, you want to look in other people's eyes, but you don't want to be hiding things from other people in order to look good.
Yeah.
You would have lots of encouragement. So if you hide things from other people, then you lack the basis for the practice entirely. Mm-hmm. One time said that the people he was looking for as students were people who were observant and also people who would not hide things about themselves.
Mm.
The hiding part is important. You know, it's a sign of integrity.
Yeah. I've also heard you talk about the importance of internalizing standards of behavior, you know, for when you're away from the Sangha. You know, we can't always be around admirable company. Can you say a little bit about that?
Well, years back, I remember Ruth Benedict did a study of Japanese culture at the end of World War II.
I remember.
The Japanese would be willing to undergo occupation if they would cooperate. And she came up with a theory of the guilt culture versus the shame culture.
Mm.
And the guilt culture is basically one in which your parents tell you, don't do that, it hurts me when you do that. And the shame culture is one where the parents say, don't do that, it makes us look bad in the eyes of the neighbors. Now, the problem with shame culture is that on the one hand, it's good in the sense that people are not ridden by guilt feelings, but there is a tendency when people have been raised in a shame culture to not care when they leave their home.
Hmm.
And the people think about them. Whereas if you've learned how to internalize these values, and this is ultimately what the training is all about, that you take your teacher's values and they become your own. So that when you're looking at your behavior, you're thinking about, well, how would my teacher look at this? Here in the forest tradition, we have pictures of John Munn. I don't know if you've ever seen any of them, but he looks like his eyes could drill right through you. And it's good to have that sort of looking at you. Well, how would a John Munn think if he saw you doing this?
Hmm.
And then after a while, you become to get to the point where you start carrying those values around, so you don't need the community in order to maintain your values, and so your sense of honor is not defined by the people immediately around you, but by the kind of ideal people that you would like to look good to, whether they're there or not.
Mm. I'm wondering, I don't know if this is too close, but I wonder if you have an example from your life in which you feel that you did hold firm to your own internal standards of behavior, regardless of the judgments of others.
Well, setting up a monastery in the West, you might probably have had experiences like this where people say, well, now that Buddhism has come to the West, we've got to change things. And I've always had to say, no, the system is really good as it's designed, and we're going to carry it through. And I've lost a number of students over this, and I've gotten a lot of criticism from some quarters. But I feel that by holding up to this, we create a community where people who really are serious about the practice feel comfortable being here. I remember being with the John Fuang, there were times when people said, well, can't we change this and can't we change that? And knowing that he wouldn't change meant that I could stick to my knowledge of what he had taught me in the past, and things would change according to people's moods or what seemed to be popular one moment versus another. It creates a much better environment for practicing. Things seem a lot more solid that way.
Mm-hmm. Have you found yourself changing anything at all?
There are a few things, like we wear socks.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And we have heater than our huts, which we didn't have in Thailand. All pretty much very minor stuff.
Mm. Reminds me of something else I thought about asking you, which is when you look to the future of Buddhism in the West, that's a big topic, of course, but I wonder what you worry about, if anything.
Well, about it's becoming too popular in some ways, because when something becomes mainstream, it picks up a lot of the bad habits of the mainstream.
Mm.
One of my nightmares, and you've probably seen these churches that have these horrible puns in their signboards in front of the church.
Sure.
And I know that, okay, Buddhism will have gone mainstream when the Buddhist temples have signboards with horrible puns.
Oh, I like a good pun.
Well, good puns, yes. It's very rare to find one on a church signboard. But you see things like, you know, what's happening with the mindfulness movement right now.
Yeah,
It's been taken over and it's been turned into an industry.
Yeah,
and there's very little concern about, well, what did the Buddha actually teach about mindfulness? I've written a couple of articles for Tricycle on this topic. And the response I get is, nobody wants to know what the Buddha taught on this topic anymore. They've got the definition that's working for them, and they don't want to hear that the definition was wrong.
Interesting. Yeah, it feels like it's been plucked out of the Buddhist tradition in some ways.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And the other problem is around the issue of dana, which is basically means generosity. But the way it's been talked about is that it becomes kind of the tip you give to teachers at the end of a retreat.
Yeah.
Just the other day, I talked to someone who said, well, he was trying to get monthly consultation with a Dharma teacher, and the Dharma teacher said, well, my dana rate is X per hour. At that point, it's not dana anymore. It's basically my payment rate.
Right, right. Forced generosity.
Right.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, let me ask you this then. What cheers you when you look forward?
Seeing young people wanting to come, realizing that this is something that's going to continue on in the next generation. I know there's a worry, especially say in the Vipassana group, they call the Korean or the community. We don't have that problem here. We've got a lot of young people coming in to join us who want to practice at the monastery. So I feel that there's something of value in the teaching, as long as you don't change it to fit too closely to the values of one particular social economic group or one particular generation. There's something of eternal value here that everybody in every generation is going to pick up, and seeing that the younger generation is picking up, that is cheering.
Yeah, I'll say. Can you say just a little bit about your daily life there at the monastery? What's it like?
Well, we have a group meditation at 5:30. People usually get up well before that, meditate on their own. Then 5:30, there's a group meditation for an hour, followed by a work period, and then the monks go for alms. Some of them go out of the monastery for alms. Some of them go to the kitchen here in the monastery. We have our meal. The lay people chant while the monks are having their meal. They have their meal, and after everybody cleans up, then everybody's free to meditate until late afternoon when we have a Q&A session. And another brief work period, and then there's a group meditation in the evening, and then people go off and meditate on their own until they're ready to go to sleep.
Mm. How many people do you have there at any given time?
We have 12 monks. We have about 12 to 15 lay people.
12 to 15 lay people living there?
Well, we have about 4 or 5 people living here, and then we have another 10, 8 or 10, depending on the season, staying either in tents or in our guest house.
Oh, yeah. You're a prolific writer and a teacher. What's next for you on your journey, on the path?
Well, for writing, I'm working on A Life of the Buddha right now, drawn from the Pali Canon. There is one by the monk Nyanamoli, which he did a good job, but it was done back in the 1950s, and we've learned a lot about Pali, and his background was more kind of European academic. My background, of course, is having been trained in the forest tradition. There are different parts of the canon, different parts of the Buddha's life that I find speak to me that did not speak to him.
Yeah.
We want to include that in the new compilation.
It seems remarkable to me that it's been since 1950 that somebody's done a serious study like that.
Right.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for taking the time, Ajahn Jeff.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Zen Crossing. For more information about the Puget Sound Zen Center, go to pszc.org.